I figured out doing church work for over 30 years that when you do something once, it's an event. When you do something twice, it's a tradition. And not just as of late, but for quite some time, during the seasons of Advent and the seasons of Lent, I've done sequences of sermons that sort of fit together. So this being the first Sunday in Lent this year, it's the first of a series of sermons that are collectively entitled From the Cross. And they talk in turn about some of the things that Jesus says while he is in the process of giving his life for all of us. They're referred to collectively as the seven last words of Jesus, but it requires four Gospels to give us all seven. There's only one thing that he says from the cross that's recorded more than once, and that's where he cries out in anguish to his Father. That's recorded in Matthew and Mark. There are three words that are recorded only in Luke, where he forgives those who are executing him, where he forgives the thief next to him, and when he commends his spirit to God. Only in Luke. And only in John, he declares that it is finished. He asks for something to drink. And in today's message, central to today's message, he has a word for his mother. It's Valentine's Day. And as Jesus says, "Behold," from the cross, the title of these thoughts today is "Behold the Love," from John's Gospel, chapter 19. But standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing near, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to his disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home. He is in the process of demonstrating and fulfilling God's promise of love by extending his arms, allowing them to be pierced. And yet, for just a second, he does uniquely in his life one thing, and that is express deep love and devotion to one person for one second, and it happens to be his mother, at the moment of his most profound anguish and suffering. Well, that's kind of what love is about. Behold your son, your mother, but behold the love beneath the sentiment. Now, I've said hundreds of times and in many different ways that love is the combination of all feelings. But some specifically today, some emotions, some realities in relationships are especially profound. When you bear witness to them, you can only say, "Behold the love." Now, the most obvious is at a moment when two people decide to marry one another. And we say, "Behold the love" in commitment. Commitment. Now, I often say what fun weddings are, especially if you're the officiant, because you get the best view in the house. And the best view happens at the moment when the bride comes in from the back. And everybody stands up and watches the bride, except me. I watch the groom watch the bride. That's the best seat in the house. It is awesome to see what they are about to do. And of course, the central point of a wedding ceremony is when they repeat their vows. And I encourage couples, when we talk about what they want to have happen in this, to use the traditional vows, the ones in the movies, the ones in the old books, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. You can go to the internet to weddingvowsjustforyou.org, I guess, or you can write your own. But there's no loopholes in "for better or worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish." And they don't even know, most of the time, how important that is, because it doesn't feel like sickness, poorer, or worse. It feels like the good stuff. But they will figure it out. And they will figure it out, and they will move through it, because of what they've promised. Now, it's a standard thing I do at wedding rehearsals. I tell everybody, if you want to know the moment, the absolute second, when two individuals become one couple, it has nothing to do with when I, at the end of it, go, I pronounce them this or that. It has everything to do with once they repeat their vows, that's when it happens. They are married because of what they say to each other. And what they say is, I am committed to you and you to me. Behold the love in commitment. And commitment is what gets people through the other side of those couplets in their vows. Better, worse, sickness, health, richer, poorer. The commitment sees them through. The commitment sees them through until, in some cases, it doesn't. I've often said to my students, or asked them, I should say, in a polling thing, how many of you remember, you know, when you were in junior high and you were going steady with what was certain to be the love of your life, right? When you're 13, 14, as it were, almost never happens. Because going steady soon results in one or the other of you getting dumped. Remember that? Thanks for bringing that up. And the point that I think is most useful is that getting dumped is good for you. It really is. Because it gives you the chance, and this is a risky thing to do, to learn more about what you need in a relationship, and about what you were unable to bring to this one that you need to learn when you bring it to some other, when you have the opportunity to bring it to someone else, and they to you. The statistics are kind of interesting. If you look at people in their first marriages, let's imagine 10,000 couples on that side of the room that are currently in their first marriages, and another 10,000 couples on this side of the room that are currently in their second or subsequent marriages. The question I pose to my students is, which group in 50 years would we look back and would have the higher divorce rate? First marriages or second and subsequent? And the data tell us, somewhat counterintuitively, that it's the second or subsequent group where the divorce rate is higher. Now, the reason for that is, echoing Albert Einstein, that when you continue to do what you know doesn't work and expect the outcome to be different, that's insane. But continuing to do what you know doesn't work in a second or subsequent marriage is the path of least resistance. The hard part is recognizing what you are about, what you need, and where to find it. We all have more or less the same sets of needs. We need security, financial and personal and maybe even emotional security. We all need a sense of autonomy, being able to set goals and achieve it, and have some independence as well. We all need power. We need to be loved. We need to belong to somebody. And, you know, we need to have some fun in our lives, among other things. But not everybody needs all those things in the same way or to the same degree. And the hard part is understanding what you need and to experience and express the vulnerability it takes to be that honest with somebody else, and see how that fits together. The Bible euphemistically uses the word to know to express intimacy. And sometimes we sort of reduce that to physical intimacy. In the Christmas story in Matthew's Gospel, it says, Joseph knew her not until they were married, and so on. But it's way more powerful and deep than that, especially in the Hebrew. The word to know, Hebrew is a very efficient language. They don't use vowels, and every little word has immense meaning. But to know someone is not only to experience a connectedness physically, but also emotionally, and most importantly, to know where the soft spots are. One of the things I learned in a marriage enrichment or counseling class when I was preparing to do this work was some of the best advice you can give people who are about to be married, that in the subsequent marriage, they will disagree. But the most important rule in the middle of a disagreement is never go for the jugular. You know where each other's emotional jugular veins are. Leave that alone. Because having been given that information is a sacred trust. to know where the soft spots are, to know what you need, to know what you bring, is a level of vulnerability, which along with commitment, you can only say, behold the love. Commitment, vulnerability. And finally, the one thing Jesus was most about from the cross, and that is sacrifice. Working toward and being a part of what it takes for others to be well, to work for their well-being. There's a story that has been all over the internet. It shows up on pretty much everybody's Facebook every couple of weeks. And it's a deep and profound story of an encounter between two people and about a third. And whether the details are exactly correct, the sentiment and the reality is absolutely real. It concerns a man who each day comes to an extended care facility to visit his wife, who is in a secure area because she is in the later stages of Alzheimer's. And he meets her each day and greets her and tends to her. Until one day someone rather uncharitably says, you know, why are you doing this? She doesn't know who you are. To which he responds, I do this because I know who she is. Nothing more needs to be said about sacrifice. And you can only say, behold the love, completely self-giving and yet reflective of the kind of commitment and vulnerability that Jesus was about fully and completely and gives us a chance to share as he looks to his mother and to the disciple he loved and says, behold. I want to summarize these thoughts with an essay by another Presbyterian minister named Frederick Buechner, whose work I encountered when I first started seminary training. And this is an essay that goes on for a little bit. It's not about Jesus or John, but about his mother. He says, the time their 12-year-old got lost in Jerusalem and they finally found him in the temple, Mary said, behold, thy father and I have sought thee sorrowing. And as things turned out, it was a shadow of things to come. It's not hard to imagine her sorrowing again when Jesus left a good, steady job in Nazareth to risk his neck wandering all over creation to proclaim whatever it was he thought he was proclaiming. Part of her sorrow was presumably that she loved him too much for himself instead of for the wild and holy business he thought he'd been called to. Another part must have been that, like just about everybody else who was closest to him in Nazareth, she never really understood what he thought he was doing, and may well have been one of the ones who, when he went back home once, decided he must be off his rocker. He's beside himself, they said, and they tried to lock him up for his own good. Maybe some of the things he said to her didn't sound as bad in Aramaic as they do in English. But even so, she can't have been too happy about the time when she told him the wine was running out at the wedding at Cana, and he said, woman, what have you to do with me? Or the time they came and told him his mother was waiting outside for him, and he said, who is my mother? Adding that whoever did the will of his father who was in heaven, that was who his mother was. For all the sentimentalizing that their relationship has come in for since, there's no place in the Gospels where he speaks some special loving word or does some special loving thing for the woman who gave him birth. You get the idea that he felt he couldn't belong truly to anybody unless he somehow belonged equally to everybody. They were all his mothers and brothers and sisters, and there's no place in the record where he offers her anything more than he offered anyone else. No place, that is, except at the very end. When cross-eyed with pain, he looked down from where they'd nailed him and said something just for her. Even here, he didn't call her mother, just woman again. And he didn't say goodbye to her or anything like that. But it's as if, here at last, he finally spoke to the awful need he must have always sensed in her. Behold your son, he said, indicating the disciple who was standing beside her. And then to the disciple, behold your mother. It was his going away present to her, really. Somebody to be the son to her that he had no way of being himself. What with a world to save, a death to die. He would be present in that disciple, he seemed to be saying, for her to live for and to live for her. He would be present in that disciple, as he is present still in all his disciples, as we draw from what he did, commitment, risk, vulnerability, and sacrifice for the well-being of someone else. At which point, the only thing left to say is, behold, behold the love. Amen.